everybody, and welcome to episode 316 of the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader, and I am joined this week by three lovely gentlemen from all across the world. To my left, I think, Andrew Martinick. How are you, man?
Oh, you're talking geographically, right, then?
I don't even know.
I was trying to think. I was like, wait,
I'm pretending that we're all sitting at a table.
Yes, I am geographically west of you, so that means I would be to the left, I guess.
Right, and straight ahead, Jerry Hildenbrand. How are you, man?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm fairly well, thank you. I think I feel the beginnings of a cold, so let's hope it passes. And I'm also passing to the right to Alex Dobie in Manchester. How are you, dude?
I'm good, yeah, and I just realized that I was going to say you should be facing north, but then I realized that all sense of direction is kind of lost because the Earth is indeed round. So we've come to this conclusion already on the AC podcast. It's going to be a good evening, I think.
I think it'll be a good evening, and we just did our first hot take of the podcast, so it's a good start. Mm-hmm. So this week we're doing a little bit different. We are going to we've asked you to submit your questions. We got a few great ones, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the topics that we didn't get to last week, including the OnePlus 3T, which was reviewed by Andrew this week, the Gear S3, which is starting to filter out to various retailers across
starting to weigh down
North
my
America.
Wrist heavily.
Hot take number two. A new Pixel update that improves things immensely, and I really like it, and so does Alex. Project Tango probably should have stayed a project, and Pixel sales, thumbs up. So we'll start with some questions, because I think that's something a lot of people are interested in. I'm certainly interested in this question, and it's from Nick. And Nick asks, what's the incentive for VPN apps to offer their service for free? And how can we stay secure on public Wi-Fi? And I like this question because this is the first week in, I think, nearly a month that Jerry's been on the podcast. And I also want to know because SurfEasy, my favorite VPN, was recently purchased by Opera. And Opera then launched its own version of it, which has unlimited bandwidth. But instead of paying $5 a month for it, it is now free. So I'm kind of skeptical about it. Jerry, what do you think? How do these companies make money, and are they selling all of your data?
If they're selling your data, if any of them do that, that's not going to be a very good way to stay in business as a VPN company. I don't think that they're selling your data. If I get a mobile app and it works really well and it's free and it does exactly what I want, I'm going to look at offerings from that company for other things. And I bet that's a big part of it. You know, if I've got a small business and I need a 12 license VPN and my favorite VPN app on my phone works really, really great, I'm going to look and see what that company offers for my, you know, more robust needs. Selling your data, we like to throw that around a lot, and most of these companies don't do it. You know, reputable companies.
That's like just you were saying,
I don't know.
Like you were saying, Jerry, it goes against the whole basis of right. having a VPN or having that product, which, you know, why would you undermine that by removing the privacy that a VPN is supposed to give you?
Right.
I think in the case of somebody like Opera, we've kind of wondered this because Opera has always offered multiple browsers and this like free data compression and all that kind of stuff. And I think their play is similar to other companies that make browsers and that they make money off of default search engine deals and things like that. Mm-hmm. And something like a VPN is just yet another reason for you to use one of their products. And it's just another surface for them to pull you into places that they make money.
Yeah, and for a long time before we had Google Chrome, that was a big reason why Mozilla was able to stay in business, because Google paid them a hell of a lot. I think it was hundreds of millions of dollars to have that default search engine on Firefox. So yeah, there are other ways that are less obvious that these companies can stay in business, even if the VPN is just like a value add feature that they don't directly make money on.
And in some cases, the free VPN, it's not going to be, you know, super high bandwidth. Not going to be really fast. it's free because they can. They make money from other parts of their business. You know, they know how to handle, you know, private communication. So another big company just contracts them to do it. And through their research and development, they find a quick, easy way to do this, and they just give it for free because they care. Don't laugh. A lot of these companies do care and want to give back to just people.
And Google kind of has this same approach, don't they? Because they have in Chrome the Data Saver feature, which is it's not a VPN technically, but it is VPN-like in that it compresses data and the data goes through Google services Google servers beforehand. You also have that in Fi, right, Andrew?
Yeah, well, all Nexus phones and the Pixel phones now as well use the same. It's the same VPN service, just the Google Wi-Fi assistant, whenever it connects to open Wi-Fi, will do the same thing passing through Google. Now, we have a better feeling for what Google does, obviously. It makes, you know, we know how Google makes money, so it's not as weird for them to offer a free VPN service, where it is a little different for other smaller companies who we don't know about.
I think we need to stop throwing around the VPN tag for Google's services because it's not private.
Well, sure, it's not a VPN in the way that a lot of people use VPNs.
It's a secure proxy that Google gets all the traffic through.
Right.
So if you're using a VPN because you don't want Google to see what you're doing, that's not going to help you.
Right. It's a VPN that keeps that you and Google are the two parties that keep things private from the rest of the world. It's not, you know, but let's remember, whenever you use a VPN, your traffic still goes out onto the public internet at some point. It's just not directly from you. It's from the exit of the VPN. So
it can't be traced back to you.
Yeah, the idea is the route from you to Google is secured. So maybe you don't trust that open Wi-Fi hotspot or anyone that might be in the vicinity that might be able to intercept that traffic. But you do trust the route from you to Google. So
yeah, absolutely.
That's where
it's a good thing. It's a good thing. I use it. I don't care if Google sees me search for stupid pictures of dogs with hats on. But it's just, you know, it's not a real VPN where you're anonymous.
Right. You're not running your own VPN back to your home and then out onto the internet. But I think Alex's point is important, that what matters there is that you're choosing to trust the VPN operator more than trust the random person that set up this open Wi-Fi network that you're using at, you know, your grocery store or the cafe down the street or the McDonald's.
Absolutely.
Right. And you may, you know, if for something like Opera, where it says in its terms of service, we do compile anonymized statistics on user behavior and location for study by SurfEasy, which is now Opera, and its customer and distribution partners for limited marketing purposes. When I say selling your data, they're not necessarily making bank on, you know, selling information about, you know, Andrew Martinick, but they're certainly compiling anonymized data and potentially selling it for marketing purposes.
It's
something
using,
that a lot of companies do.
Still using your data for commercial gain, which maybe is what people might have issue with.
I do with a lot of companies. Opera is not one of them. Opera, I trust.
Now owned by a Chinese company.
I know.
That is something that you may have to wonder about.
As long as they, at least we assume this is the source code for the stuff they use. They make enough of that available that the right people are saying it's okay to use. I'm okay with it. But now you've got
me
paranoid.
I'm okay with it too. And I actually think what they did with SurfEasy was very respectful. And I, you know, the company that bought them, I forget the name, but they made a number of, you know, fairly large acquisitions like Opera over the last few years. But, you know, it's not to say that you can't inherently trust a company that's been acquired by, you know, another larger company, but it's also just being aware that when you have a free service, and everybody listening to this podcast is a Google user, you have to know that you're giving up some of your personal information. So with a VPN, all of your data, all of your traffic is passing through. It's something to keep in mind. They know what phone you're using. They know how much bandwidth you're using. They know a lot about you, whether it's anonymized or not. So as long as you're okay with that, then continue using it. I don't see a problem with it.
The second part of Nick's question is, how can we stay secure on public Wi-Fi? You can't. You can use a VPN. You can, you know, do whatever you want. You can use your own Wi-Fi at home, and you can't stay secure. What you have to do is decide how secure you need it to be. If you're transmitting, you know, information that is life or death, if somebody gets a hold of it, you're not going to be able just to send it on Wi-Fi through regular channels. That stuff
you probably don't want to be sending that over the public internet anyway, right, if that's the case.
Right. There's just, what level of security do you need? I do not care that if somebody picks up my phone and reads the text I send to my wife. They'll probably find them hilarious. But if I did have things that I care deeply about, I wouldn't use public Wi-Fi. I probably wouldn't use an Android phone. I would take measures that just sound crazy, but that's what you need to do if you want to be very, very secure. And that's just the way it is. This stuff is out there, and there are really, really smart people that it's easy to harvest the data. It's just finding out a way to do something with it other than just a bunch of ones and zeros. There are smart people out there.
And most of us aren't interesting enough for people to want to target anyway.
What's interesting,
for yourself.
I read a story on Motherboard yesterday about a hacker in Tel Aviv who was mining through the security features of the public Wi-Fi network, and he hacked it and was able to get all of the data passing through it, all of the information. But he didn't do it for nefarious reasons. He actually did it because he could. And then he passed on the information to the company that oversees the public Wi-Fi system there. And they were so appreciative of it, of what he did, that they, because they make their own commercial routers, they sent him a whole bunch of product from as a thanks and for in perpetuity. Now he's a loyal customer of theirs. And he, you know, it's one of those mutually beneficial things where he helped them patch a very, very dangerous zero-day exploit, and as a result, he got free stuff.
And actually, there was a similar-ish story that broke, I think it was a couple of years ago now, about a worm that was released to specifically find a very common firmware vulnerability in a certain kind of router. I forget which kind it was. But instead of doing anything nefarious with it, it was designed to patch that security hole and then broadcast itself out to other similar routers. So it's kind of funny how you have an actual person doing this, but then actually at the same time, you can have what's designed to be malware, but something which can actually have a benevolent result as well.
Oh, that's so weird.
It's Noel on the surface, but I feel safer knowing everybody else is safer.
Right.
If somebody gets Dan's phone and can break in there, they're going to have information about me. I hope I'm in his address book. It's stuff that I don't care. I don't care if you know my address or my phone number. It's in the phone book. But it's still my information on other people's phones and computers and everything else. So I want their stuff to be secure too.
Yeah, so the name of this thing that I was talking about is YFATCH is the name of it, that is designed to pass itself onto routers. It has a bunch of code in there to identify common loopholes in networks that it affects. And it spreads in the same way as malware, but instead vaccinates devices that it infects to all these vulnerabilities. So it's kind of funny. Broke, I think, just last year, October.
Well, good for those people. We need more.
And Jerry, you are in my address book, by the way. So let's move on to the next question. This is from our own Ara Wagner. And she asks, what is the one device you can't leave the house with besides your phone? And she says, mine is her headphones. Yeah, I don't know.
My other phone. Your other phone. It depends if where you're going, how long you're going to be out of the house, what if you're traveling seriously. I mean, it's a boring one, but I guess power bank is always, you know, if you're not sure when you're going to be back, if you're traveling, it's going to be a long day, like on, you know, air travel or whatever, phone in one pocket, power bank in the other. Smartwatch, yeah. Maybe? Does that count, I guess?
Yeah.
Less of an essential, I suppose.
Yeah, I've yet to meet a smartwatch that I've found essential to my leaving the house, but
I can't think of anything really. I mean, if I leave my wallet at home, I just deal with it because I have various ways to pay with my phone. I think headphones for me would probably be the one. I think increasingly having a pair of decent earbuds that hopefully doesn't need to, you know, increasingly doesn't need to be plugged in. So a good pair of wireless Bluetooth earbuds is a valuable thing to have on you.
And looking ahead to the bleak dongle life future, maybe headphone dongle would be something that you wouldn't want to leave the house without as well.
Yeah, well, I was trying to avoid that. That's just terrible.
I mean, my thing is, I shouldn't say always because it's not 100% of the time. As often as possible, I always have a laptop with me too, just because of, you know, what our job is. But I think if you're talking about just mobile accessories, I would find something like a power bank more essential to me than headphones.
Or either of those two things more than a smartwatch, which is always going to be, there's nothing essential that a smartwatch really serves.
And for me, it's a universal power bank, something that just has a USB port on it that, you know, I have a lot that have a built-in lightning connector, a built-in micro USB connector, and it's like, those aren't very useful. You know, you want something that's generic and can work to power up my phone, power up my friend's phone, whatever. You know, I don't think anything else matters if your phone's dead. You know, if you need to leave the house and you're not sure how long you're going to be out, like Alex said, you want one of these compact, like 5 or 10,000 milliamp hour batteries.
I tell you, that's why I really like the Samsung. I think it's 5,200 milliamp hour one, the one they released last year with the GS6, because that is exactly the size of a GS6 Edge. 5,200 milliamp hours, you guaranteed at least one charge for pretty much any phone out there. Does quick charge too. Actually, apparently will do rapid charging on the Pixel as well somehow. Also works with Huawei phones. So as long as you remember to bring the right cable with you, then you're pretty much good to go.
I just finished recharging that one because I brought it to the Sounders match last night.
You're complicated.
Works charm.
Yeah.
Yes, Jerry, what do you walk out of the house with just a bag full of nickels and, you know, go hitchhike down the road?
Yeah, a pack of zigzags, and I'm good.
Is that a device?
It can be used with one.
Interesting.
I
recommend a pair of wireless Bluetooth earbuds? Is there something that we all agree on is pretty good?
So surprisingly, I forget the exact model number, but there was a pair of LG Tone earbuds, which are surprisingly good, have surprisingly good battery life. You wouldn't necessarily think LG in terms of audio, but for a decent, basic, compact set of neck buds, that's what I think
we recommended last week. I see more of those LG Tone ones out there, you know, in use by normal people than any other brands.
And it's surprising because... Go ahead.
I would say I see enough of them to actually recognize them, which is, you know, everything else just looks like a generic set of, you know, Bluetooth headband earphone things. But I see enough LG Tones that I know which ones they are.
Mm-hmm. And having used them, they are actually pretty good. And having, you know, used a lot of neckbuds alongside them, like...
I'll say if you have a Samsung phone, which is 80% of the people out there listening, anything that uses the Samsung level technology is actually going to sound pretty good on your phone. Not as good as a good pair of wired earbuds, but
they use AptX?
They use a specially licensed version of AptX that's even higher quality. It's part of the standard, but nobody that I know of is using it except for Samsung.
So the Samsung ones, I forget the actual branding. Search this now so we can actually have a...
Well, I have the level U's here, which are the super cheap ones that I don't really recommend those. The higher end ones, I can't remember. They're like level U something or another, but they're like $100. They're very comparable to the high-end Tone Infiniums or whatever they are from LG. I just don't really care for the neck bud style. It's like too much stuff going on. I think at that point, I would prefer to just have over ear or on ear Bluetooth headphones if I'm going to have this thing around my neck and all that.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So for Bluetooth, I've been using the Samsung level actives, which are just little, they're just earbuds with little clips on them. Shorter battery life, obviously, but they're actually the same. You know, when you wad them up and put them in your pocket or your bag, they're the same size as a pair of wired earbuds. That's the only reason why I use them is I can't be bothered to carry around big headphones.
And there is a trade-off in terms of battery life. They're the ones that I was going to give a anti-recommendation to because they're just kind of crap. Those were the level U's that I think they gave away at some press conference that were just awful.
Yeah, those are the cheap ones.
Yeah, they're really not great at all. The level actives, I think, you know, comparable quality, actually more comfortable because they don't have the weird shaped buds on them. Less battery life, of course. I think the Bluetooth reception is a little bit wonky sometimes. Like, it's more susceptible to interference and movement than...
Yeah, those small ones, they don't have the power to broadcast
Unless you're basically sitting still or standing still or whatever, they don't do a great job, but they're okay. They'll do. And like you said, they don't take up as much space as a regular set of neck buds.
Mm. Amazon keeps pushing these Anchor sound buds on me. They're on sale right now. It's $27 Canadian, which is about $20 US. And it's 4 stars, 443 reviews, 8 hours of battery, and IPX4 splash proof rated. So I'm going to try them.
Yeah, that's worth $27 right there if they sound just decent.
Yeah, we'll see. I have the Jaybird X2s, and I could never get a good seal in those. I tried all the different earpieces and ways to fit them in, and I just could never find a way to wear them comfortably. So those are, everybody talks about how those are the best. Now they have the X3s, but I just couldn't get into them. So yeah, I think we should do a cheap wireless earbud roundup.
I think you should.
That sounds like a painful thing to do, but I'm all for you volunteering to do it.
But maybe this time next year, wireless headphones are going to be a thing you almost have to have.
I think there will be.
I think it's getting there.
Yeah. I mean, whether you like it or not, Apple is pushing that with the way they're going. I'm sure we'll see a bunch of Android phone makers.
Apple copying Leico.
I mean, my big thing is, like I said earlier, I'm always leaving the house with a laptop or two or three phones and a tablet and whatever.
Yeah.
Right now, nothing in the Bluetooth world handles switching between devices as easily as me just plugging in my nice wired pair of earbuds. And when I'm listening to a podcast on my phone and I sit down, open my laptop, I unplug and just plug it into my laptop. I unplug, plug it into my tablet. I'm already having to carry around a wired pair of headphones because I have my laptop with me. So having my Bluetooth earbuds on me for when I'm walking around now means I'm carrying two pairs of headphones. So it's just more annoyance.
Yeah, and it's almost like the convenience of Bluetooth that you get from not having wires all over the place is immediately just eliminated by the fact that if you have, say, a laptop and a tablet and a phone, or multiple phones, and you switch on those Bluetooth earphones, almost completely random as to which one it actually decides to connect to.
Yeah, I have no idea what it's paired to, and it takes time. I'm like, you know, I could be out of the house and two blocks away by the time I could get these things repaired to the right phone.
Yeah, super annoying.
Oh, what? My favorite thing is, so my car is parked directly underneath my living room because of the way that my house is shaped. It sounds weirder than it is. And when my wife comes home from work and she forgets to turn off the Bluetooth speaker in the car, whenever I get a call, it goes straight to the Bluetooth headpiece every single time. So hello, 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 and then nothing. And then I'll realize a few seconds later. And it's without fail, it happens every time. And it's just one of those things that Bluetooth is a blessing until it's a curse, but it's more often a curse. And I still don't think that anybody has quite figured out how to make Bluetooth work across all different devices with multiple pairings, etc. It's just such a pain in the ass.
Plantronics has some stuff. I know a person who works from home, and they have a provided by the company. It's a Plantronics. Just looks like a cheap pair of wire headphones, you know, with little on-ear things and a mic. And it's Bluetooth, and the battery life is piss poor, but it can connect to three devices simultaneously.
And a lot of Bluetooth headphones could do that as well, but it's confusing if, in addition to the device that you want to connect to, you also have like random input from, say, your phone or your tablet or your laptop.
Yeah,
right. Choosing the audio routing from you know, there is rough.
It's simultaneous is the key. If you know, Dan's phone connects to the Bluetooth in his wife's car, but it could also connect to the headphones he's wearing at the same time. Nobody in the car would benefit from hearing the music that's coming out, but Dan would hear the phone call.
I think the way this is all going is that in the future, every single Bluetooth thing is just going to have a display so you can just control this stuff. It's the only way to manage this insanity.
Or, I mean, this was kind of the idea, geez, 2-3 years ago or whatever, where all these Bluetooth speakers were going to have NFC tags in them, and all you do is tap your phone to it, and then it knows the last thing that tapped the speaker is what it's going to route the audio from, and then if somebody else wants to take it over, they come by, they tap the speaker, and then that just never really went anywhere.
That only ever seemed to happen with initial pairing, and then they just didn't take it any further than that.
Right.
Okay, so let's move on. Because this is a question that I've been curious about, too. Richard Norris asks, have any of you come across a bathroom or waterproof, mistproof speaker with Google Cast built in? Now, Google Cast just got renamed today, right? So it's sure Chromecast enabled.
Chromecast built in.
Chromecast built in, rather, instead of Google Cast. But that's besides the point. So do we know of any Chromecast built-in Bluetooth speakers that are waterproof?
The issue is they're all wired, right?
Yeah,
like they're all powered.
Mm-hmm.
The initial question would be: are there any battery powered Chromecast speakers?
I mean the sort of MacGyver solution to that is you just get a normal wired one and put it in a little Ziploc bag. Kind of low tech, less than ideal, but will work with just about anything, and you'll get reasonable
protection.
But that's
what I'm thinking.
You get your favorite Bluetooth portable speaker, and the next time Chromecast Audio goes on sale for $9.99, buy it and plug it into the aux port. There you go.
But now that plugged into a wall, and now that portion is not waterproof. So, you know, people don't have power outlets in their showers for good reasons. So,
people are talking about taking it inside the shower?
Well, he wants a waterproof, bathroom-proof speaker. Just like I have this, you know, JBL clip speaker that's Bluetooth and wireless, and I clip it on my shower head and take a shower in the morning.
Maybe we're thinking about this the wrong way. And if this product doesn't exist, then maybe the better option is just a waterproof phone with a decent speaker.
Or one of these Bluetooth speakers.
Yeah.
Because I think the problem with having, I could be wrong. I haven't seen a speaker that's solely battery powered that offers Google Cast or Chromecast built in.
Well, maybe he's thinking that if you need to have your phone or something else within Bluetooth range of something that's in your bathroom, maybe that's problematic, and maybe it's easier just to do it through Wi-Fi. Maybe.
Sure.
Get on Amazon and buy a cheap pair of powered speakers with a 3.5 millimeter jack and a Chromecast audio and just plug it in permanently and set it on the shelf. And whenever you go take a shower, say, cast to the bathroom and take your shower.
Well, yeah. Or the most simple thing would just be buy one of these $100 Google Homes that are on sale and just set it on the bathroom counter. Don't put it in the shower, and I think you'd be fine.
No, it needs to be in the shower, like directly under you while you're showering.
Well, that's an interesting question. How water resistant is the home? I mean, not necessarily
at all.
But I mean, if you set that in your bathroom and the steam, the steam harm the components after a while?
It's going to be the fact that you're going to have increased moisture in the air and then it's going to condense inside the thing is going to be the problem.
I mean, we're going to get all home improvement on this, but I'm going to assume most people don't have like a steam shower sauna level bathroom going on
I think you are underestimating the audience of the Android Central podcast there. But so, anyway,
if you have enough of an issue with ventilation in your bathroom that you have like lots of moisture in your bathroom all the time, then you're going to have drywall problems, paint problems, fixture problems. You shouldn't be worrying about your speaker. I think your speaker is the last of your worries.
Yeah, you need a good vent.
So if your bathroom is properly ventilated, you're not going to have any problem just leaving a Google Home in your bathroom. That's not going to be an issue.
I leave...
And it looks like an air freshener already, so it's perfect.
Google Home's going to be just as waterproof as, you know, that water pick or electric toothbrush base you have plugged into the wall.
Yep.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. I leave a UE Boom in my bathroom. And those are waterproof, but it's awesome. It's a great product. Battery lasts like 15 hours. I just turn it on. It connects to my phone right away. And I mean, I've no issue leaving my Pixel in the bathroom because it's ventilated. So I leave the Pixel on the counter while I'm in the shower. It's playing music to the UE Boom. It may cut down on the lifespan of the phone by a little bit, but I don't think so. It's in a case. It's fine. This week's episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Harry's. Harry's makes great razors for less. If you're looking to save some money from those expensive drugstore brands, Harry's is just the ticket. You go to harrys.com and you order your set. And if you like, they will send you a bunch of razors every month through a subscription right in the mail. It's really easy. But that's not all. Harry's actually makes better razors than the ones that you find in the drugstores. Not only are they great, high-quality 5-blade razors, but they have a flex hinge for a more comfortable glide. The blades are trimmer so that they reach those hard-to-reach places, and each one has a lubricating strip along with a textured handle for more control. Harry's was started by two friends who just wanted to pay less for razors. Razors should not be complicated, so they decided to design their own, and to manufacture them, they partnered with a factory in Germany. And they liked the product so much that they actually bought the plant, which is pretty cool. Now they make razors for less and they send them right to you. And if you don't like them, which you probably will, but if you don't, Harry's will refund you 100% of your money. That's a pretty great deal. So how do you get the starter set? Well, the starter set comes with a razor handle, moisturizing shave cream, 3 precision-engineered 5-blade cartridges, and a travel cover, and that's all just for $15. It's a great way to get started with Harry's. And for a limited time, you get even more if you use the offer code AC at checkout. So you get an extra $5 off the already discounted $15 price for a starter kit by using the offer code AC at checkout when you go to harrys.com. Again, AC, harrys.com, get a better face, except, you know, you don't have a choice because that's the one your mama gave you. But anyway, you can get a softer face, and that's all that matters. Back to the show.
And I'm looking at Amazon for Google Cast speakers, like standalone speakers, and first of all, there aren't that many, and second of all, they all have really bad ratings on Amazon for one reason or another. That's very frustrating.
Don't buy one from LG. I'm sorry, LG, but you know why LG, and now everybody else is going to know.
Well, I see the LG one's 2.5 stars.
Yeah,
so.
LG isn't worried about doing whatever needs to be done to include their stuff in grouping.
Ah, Which is kind of the whole point of having a cast-enabled speaker.
Yeah, if I want to have a bunch of them around my house, I need to be able to group them together. And, you know, now that that's a thing, LG's just not concerned about updating the firmware to make it happen.
The highly rated one I see here is a Grace Digital Cast Dock X2. It looks like it just has, it's got left, right, just wired speaker input, aux in, and Chromecast support. Is $92 on Amazon. So
you ought to order one. It's if you don't want to fool with it, have it sent here. We need to order one of those.
It says free. It's free same day delivery. I could get it here now. I could have to order within the next 7 minutes, though.
Do it. Click the button. Well, we get this. we've gotten this question enough times that if we find an answer, we need to talk about it.
We have. Well, so this is the interesting thing. After the last podcast, we had a comment on our last podcast, maybe the one before, talking about how somebody had bought 5 or 6 Google Homes just to use them as group speakers. And I thought that was kind of amazingly overkill to spend that amount. But then when I look at all these speakers are more expensive than Google Homes are. So if you're this one on discount is normally $150. So, a home is $100 today, you know, it will be $130 next week.
But for $105, I can build a sound system with a tiny amp, a Chromecast audio, and a set of Pioneer speakers. It will just blow the ever-loving blank out of you.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, come on, Jerry.
Yeah.
You can build something like that, but somebody who's going to buy 5 Google Homes does not want to build a speaker system.
Well, plug into the hole.
No, they want to buy a fully contained thing, plug in one cable, and have it work. And for that price, Google Home does a pretty good job of that. You can save money and you can go other routes, but you know, if you want to, and you're talking about consistent audio across. I mean, the Google Home speaker is not fantastic, let's be honest, but it's pretty good. And if you want something consistent, that's not a too bad of a deal. I mean, I laughed at it at first, but it's not too bad of a deal. But I should order one of these either way. See how it matches up. I'll put it in my bathroom.
I mean, what I'm interested in is, like, I rely on Sonos speakers throughout my house. I have 3. And I'm thinking Sonos Play 1, which is awesome, is $199. It's down to $149 for Black Friday, but regularly $199. You can get 1.5 Google Play or Google Homes for the same amount. And even though the price isn't as good, soon Sonos will integrate with Echo. So the question is it worth spending more on something like a Sonos to get slightly better sound? I don't know how much better sound the Sonos is than the Google Home, but I'd imagine it's a fair amount.
For some people, yeah.
Because Sonos is great, and Sonos now it integrates with every service you want. It'll integrate with Alexa starting next year, and it's built right into the Spotify app, so it's easier to control. I'm just thinking,
I was impressed with Sonos. If you want something, you just plug into the wall and it works and it sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
A little expensive, but Sonos is, you know, I think Sonos is a little better than Bose, a lot better than some of these other solutions. And if that's what you want, you just need it to sound good and you have an extra $49, just buy the damn Sonos. If you're like me and you want something that sounds a little bit better and don't care about having to deal with wires, you build your own. Or if you're like that dude and just loves Google, you buy 5 Google Homes. This is going to be, what do you need and what do you want? There's lots of ways to get music through your house.
And I think you should talk about that one day. Talk about that system. Maybe on food? What was the other podcast we were going to build?
Oh, geez. We've had so many wonderful ideas. I just can't
keep
them straight.
Food and bookshelf speakers and zigzag podcast.
And we had the cable podcast as well, didn't we, I think? And the headphone jack podcast.
Oh, the icon cast.
Oh, yes. The icon cast. That was it, yeah.
As opposed to iconoclast.
There's a post on Android Central how to put one of those together. It uses a little bit. It's going to cost you $150, but it uses really good Pioneer speakers and a little Class T amp and a Chromecast audio, and it's going to sound better than anything you can buy for under $500.
Okay, so let's move on. We have a couple more questions. Domenico Lamberti, who's a fan of the site, asks, why are companies still selling Lollipop-powered phones in 2016?
Or KitKat-powered tablets.
Or KitKat tablets. Yeah, and I wonder, that's a good question, because obviously Google would prefer that they don't.
Because they just don't care, because they want to sell you cheap crap and not worry about maintaining it, and that's what they had lying around, and that's it. Yeah, because they're terrible.
And it would take, they developed it 2-3 years ago, and they said, well, we could spend additional time and money on a new software version for these new phones.
Except
or we
on the
not.
Other hand, Control-C, Control-V.
You're right.
So, yeah.
Is that it? Don't they have to tweak the software for each particular piece of hardware?
They do, but if you have something you've already built that is for similar hardware that is older, then, and if you're on a limited budget, and if you don't have any engineering of your own, if you're a smaller company, then maybe that's why you do it.
And the answer is no. Buy some of these $29 phones from Amazon and check them out sometimes. Half of it doesn't work because it's just generic software, AOSP developer key slapped on the thing and it ships. It makes a phone call, so they sell it. And that's just, let's make money today and not care what happens in the future. A lot of companies
do it. I'm looking at Boost Mobile because they're one of the big carrier offerings in the U.S. that offers just the cheapest possible phones. And two of the three phones they're highlighting in their under $50 page are running Marshmallow. The one that's not is the Moto E. We all know about that. But the LG X Power for $99 and the LG K3 for $29 are both running Marshmallow.
Huh. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, they're never going to be updated and it's probably still slow and terrible, but they are.
It's slow and terrible and at least reasonably up to date.
Right. I mean, it's got newer software on it than a Galaxy Note 3.
Ooh.
While we're on the topic, it was announced this week that the Moto Z and Z Force will be the first non-Pixel Daydream phones, and they will also be updated to Nougat. Well, they'll be updated to Nougat and then become the first non-Pixel Daydream compatible phones.
Yeah, I need to go back and talk about the Mate 9 at this point, because we have units in hand. It is not compatible with the Daydream app right now. So it's supposed to be Daydream compatible, but you can't load the app on there. I don't believe Google VR services is on there either. So even though devices are out there, it's not actually released. And you can't really use that on there at the moment.
Yeah, and that's interesting. It seems like Motorola made it seem like they worked with Google to get Daydream support. So Google is, even though a phone may run Nougat like the Mate 9 or the LG V20, Google has to explicitly whitelist those phones. And they may actually be able to do it without having to issue a software update. It may just be one day those phones will be allowed to download the VR compatibility suite and that's it.
Yeah, possible. I mean, we know the Mate 9 units, we have a pre-production and they're waiting on a software update anyway, so that could well come with the final release of that.
There's a compatibility test for Daydream of some sort. I don't know what it's called, but your phone has to meet certain hardware requirements that are probably a little bit fluid, and the software has to be able to do certain things in a reasonable amount of time, and if you meet both of those things, Google can approve you for the Daydream apps. I'm going to imagine a whole lot of internal company politics are involved here too.
Well, I'm just impatiently waiting for my Moto Z to get updated because I really like that phone. But I've been so impressed with Android 7.1 on the Pixel that I don't think I could go back to using a Marshmallow phone. Speaking of which, Alex, you've been using the Galaxy S7 Edge with Nougat over the last few days, and you've been writing about it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience?
So I I kind of gave you the short version on the last podcast, but this has been updated a little bit since I last spoke. Basically, an update to stop Facebook crashing, but there are going to be more updates in the future as this program continues towards the middle of December. I've been impressed with it so far. I mean, coming from this to the Pixel, it's obvious there are certain advantages that the Pixel has, like touch response is kind of noticeably faster on the Pixel. But I think this is a really important and really big update for the GS7. It, like I was saying last week, telegraphs a lot of stuff about where Samsung's UX is going as we move towards the Galaxy S8 next year. Basically, we've pretty much completely abandoned this bluish, tealish UI that we were adopting from, I think it was the Note 4 going through towards the Note 5 and S6 Edge Plus last year. That's now completely gone. Everything's either like bright grays or whites, and you have very minimalist approach to icon design, like outlines and a focus on relatively fine fonts. The bluest thing that you have on here is the notification shade, which I think Samsung has already indicated is going to be changing color. So it's kind of a brightish blue, which looks a little bit weird right now, but whatever, that's probably going to be changing. Like I said last week, Squircles are back. I'm more or less fine with the Squircles. You also have display scaling, so 1080p is now the default resolution. You can go alert to 1440 if you want, but 1080p is what you're set at as you set it up fresh after a factory reset. And it's been nice to get to know this phone again. I think it's going to be an important upgrade for it when eventually it lands. It's just a case of, as with any Samsung update, are they going to be able to work with the carriers to get this thing out on time? Obviously, the US carriers this time have been involved with the whole testing program for this. So people have been testing in the US. So you're probably not going to be looking at a situation where, like we have with the GS6, you're waiting until like May to get the update. That's probably not going to happen. But at the same time, it's probably only going to be Korean devices and the unlocked European ones that get the update probably before the end of the year. Everything else, you'd be looking maybe February-ish, shortly before the GS8 lands. But I like it. The biggest thing for me has been going back to any Marshmallow phone right now. The whole notification setup there just feels so old and clumsy after you've used Nougat. And it's been nice to have all the benefits of the GS7, like the wireless charging, like the curved screen, the design, which I think is still more striking and better looking objectively than the Pixel. But also get a lot of the benefits of the Pixel, so the task switching, split screen working in a lot of apps, and the notification setup too. So I'm enjoying it a lot.
Yeah, I know that, you know, we spoke about it a bit last week, but it's nice to hear your now that you've used it for a solid few days, mm-hmm. as your daily driver. It's nice to see that it's holding up. One other phone that got an update this week. We're getting an update, I guess, is the Google Pixel. It's still Android 7.1, and it is still the same experience. But there are two new move gestures that are, I think, some of the biggest improvements, small update, big improvement to the overall usability. And it's rolling out to Canadian devices first for some reason. We're not
this
really sure
no
why.
This makes no sense to me at all.
But
it's ass monkeys.
The build is actually it indicates that it's a preview build.
What's really weird about that is it's the same preview build number as the 7.1.1 preview that's going out to Nexus devices, which makes no sense because it's a different version of Android. But whatever, who knows what's going on there?
Well, now let's be clear: this isn't an Android update. This is just like getting a TouchWiz update on your Samsung phone. This is a Pixel update.
Correct. Sure, but if you go to the Android build number, it is the exact same build number that you have on the second developer preview for 7.1.1 on Nexus phones right now, which seems really strange.
But the build number on the Nexus preview phones is the Android build number. The build number on your Pixel is the Pixel software version.
It's the same string.
I played bingo the other night and probably had some of those same numbers too. The Pixel is not a Google Android division device. It's a Google hardware division device that uses its own software separate and outside of Android, which is what Google should have done from the beginning with Nexus phones. Shut up, Google Home. But they didn't, and they probably quickly learned how much more benefit they, you know, and easier things could be, and that's why they're doing it now. Android isn't getting updated. It always supported this stuff. The Pixel just didn't have it.
Yeah, I mean, who knows why that build number is there? It's just, it's funny that you can tell us to a certain degree what is going on with the build of Android based on the build number, because the first number is the major release. It's N or M or L or whatever. The second number is the code branch, so it's like alpha release. And this has kind of been in flux a little bit. It doesn't always mean anything. The review devices we got were A for the branch, which who knows what that means. But normally it's like alpha release, M for maintenance release, P for preview, and F for the quarter of the month. And they actually went through the entire cycle of ABCD all the way up to Z. And now they're back on ABCD, and F, I think, is the current one. And the next number is the number of days. And after that, you have some extra letter, which sometimes indicates that it's the number of days, the number of builds within that day or something like that. So it isn't just a meaningless build string. It does have, it does tell you a certain amount about the software that it's running. But again, you maybe shouldn't read too much into that, because it does go off the rails sometimes.
So why is this just randomly arriving for some phones that are on that are unlocked phones on Canadian carriers?
Google, that's the thing.
Because Google has agreements with Canadian carriers. They actually sell through Canadian carriers, and Canadian carriers use Band 4.
Here's the other thing is, that is true, but they're not whitelisting only Canadian devices that are sold through carriers. It's any Canadian SKU,
right, that's what I'm saying.
Even sold through the Google store. So
any phone on a Canadian carrier.
The model that I have is exactly the same as the model Andrew has. And it's interesting that they are finding a way, either through IMEIs or some other, you know, maybe by the SIM card in the device, to send particular updates to these Canadian phones.
Yeah, I'm sure it's your SIM card data. It identifies you as a Canadian customer.
And as I indicated, that was funny. My Pixel XL hasn't even received the latest update to get the November security patch.
Yeah,
so my Pixel is on a newer version than my XL.
Yeah, yours is a review unit, though. It had that weird build that was NAE63, whatever.
I don't know. It got a previous update. It just hasn't gotten this one. So I don't know.
Weird.
So let's talk a little bit about what's in the update, because it's going to be coming to all Pixel owners eventually. Two new move gestures. The first is raise to wake, which was a very popular feature on the Nexus 6P and 6 when the ambient screen was introduced with Lollipop. And for some reason, it wasn't included in the Pixel when it was released. So that's great. Now I can pick up the phone and the ambient screen turns on. I tap it and the full AMOLED display turns on. You can also now double tap to turn on the device if it's just sitting on a table. And if you miss the first ambient pulse, you can then just double tap it. Both of them are not new. So anybody accusing me of, you know, just going crazy about these features because they're new, that's not why. It's because they were the missing link, in my opinion, for what made the Pixel almost perfect. And now that is exactly what I think it is. It's one of the most mature and full-featured Android devices you can buy, with two extra reasons to love it.
And I think it plays to the way a lot of working people use their phones throughout the day. It's on a desk. You don't necessarily want to pick it up and press the button, because that's a very precise gesture. If you can just lift it up and then the ambient screen activates, it's like super easy to see if you need to actually then unlock it. Whereas before, you had to pick it up, you had to find the button, press the button. It's just so much easier. And again, if it's on the table, if you don't want to pick it up, double tap, it activates the ambient display. You're not lighting up the entire screen, so you're not wasting battery power, and you can just take a look and see if there's anything there that you need to pay attention to.
Exactly. So the other thing that seems to be fixed is the Band 4 problem. And we talked about this a little bit. Even though it was never really confirmed by Google, some Canadians whose carriers rely on Band 4 for LTE were losing their connections regularly, and they were either dropping down to HSPA Plus or just losing their signal completely. This seems to have fixed it, but it doesn't seem to have fixed, for people who have sideloaded it in South America who were having the same problem, it doesn't seem to have fixed it for them. So I don't know why, but Jerry May.
You said the same problem. No, It's
well, yeah, it's a similar symptom. That's correct. Actually, right. we should talk about that. It's a similar symptom, but some of the biggest carriers in South America, like Claro, they rely exclusively on band yep. 4 for their LTE, whereas in Canada, any carrier has both band 4 AWS, sorry, band 4 band 7 and band 12. So T-Mobile in the
US also uses band 4. Have we heard of people in the US having this problem? And actually, if it is a band 4 issue, why is that not being rolled out on T-Mobile as well?
It was the way that different parts of the world use the spectrum differently. Canada does things a little bit different than T-Mobile does. South America does things a little bit different than either. And the phone was probably just built to work with T-Mobile in Mountain View. And that worked. And they just need to tweak things to make the compatible equipment more compatible with slightly different software requirements.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly what it is, because Canadian carriers mirror the way that T-Mobile works in many ways. T-Mobile relies on band 4. They also use 700 megahertz. But the carriers that seem to have been most affected in Canada were Bell and TELUS, and they share a network. Whereas Rogers, which uses mainly band 12 as opposed to band 4, didn't have this problem. So even though they all share similar spectrum, the one that emphasized band 4 seems to have been the one that was more affected. But now it seems like that's fixed. So hopefully Google will roll out an update to South American Pixel users and get those fixed too.
I'm sure. I mean, it's probably just a prioritization thing. You know, if you say it worked fine on Rogers, it worked fine in the U.S., it's because band 4 works, but it's not. Let's try to do everything we can on band 4. And maybe it just, I'm sure that it's, the hardware is compatible. It just needs adjusting.
It could also be that obviously Google doesn't sell the Pixel on Timo. Google does sell the Pixel through the Canadian carriers. I'm not sure what arrangements exist in South America. But if you have a carrier that's an official partner, then maybe that's going to be a priority more than just a general network with an unlocked device where there's an issue there. Maybe that's why we're seeing this mid-month release, as opposed to having them waiting until early December when 7.1.1 is going to drop.
Yeah, even though Canadian carriers are small potatoes.
And terrible still with sold. Updates normally, right? That's the hilarious thing.
Well, okay, so go ahead.
I was just going to say that was a big part of the reason for the Pixel to start with. Let's fix crappy phones that get updates way too late.
Yeah, that's true. All right, let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about Project Tango. We don't really know too much about it. Well, we don't personally have the phones. That was Russell Hawley who reviewed the Lenovo Fab 2 Pro. But who here has actually used Tango?
I've used it.
And that's exactly how he feels about it.
Pretty much.
I was going to say, is that intentional or what?
No, it just caught me off guard, but it fits. It's some really innovative stuff, but why put it on a phone you sell to consumers?
Precisely.
It's pointless. I don't hate Lenovo. A lot of people hate Lenovo after they bought Motorola. I don't. You know, if you want a great, big, huge phone that's just mediocre in all other areas, buy the thing, but you can spend your money a whole lot better.
Yeah, fair enough. So it is now.
There's also the fact that a lot of stuff is just, if you read Russell Hawley's review on AndroidCentral.com, a lot of stuff is just straight up broken. You have this weird thing that seems to pervade a lot of Chinese phones where notifications just aren't visible because they mess with the way that the notification shade works. A lot of apps are very crashy. It just seems like the QA hasn't been there. It's the software either. They've been in such a rush to test this, or the QA has been focused so much on the Tango side of things, that making sure the phone just works as a phone has taken a back seat.
I think you might be right, because when I got to see it, it was a thing for developers building applications and, you know, phone firmware for assistive technology. You can use Tango to map rooms ahead of time.
But then you can't use Tango to see your Gmail notifications. It's
right,
crazy.
Right. So they focused a lot on making it, you know, all these sensors that can do all the things that works. So maybe that's where all the, you know, the work went to on that stuff.
I think that even if this was somehow perfectly executed, which you couldn't have expected for the first time out in a consumer product, but you could have expected maybe something a little closer to perfectly executed, it would still be a gigantic, heavy phone with this feature that, even if it were implemented properly, would not be enough reason to buy a phone on its own.
I saw nothing there that I would want, you know, for work or play, unless I was doing something that could use the data all the sensors acquired.
Yeah, I think this is a perfect it's a perfect example of what was done right on something like the Moto Z, but not done right on this Tango phone, is that so on the Moto Z, you have the modularity, but that huge feature is something that people may actually like, but it also doesn't get in the way of just using the phone as a phone. Whereas with the Tango phone, this makes this thing gigantic and heavy, and all the software is very weird because it has to incorporate big battery, bigger screen, all the extra sensors and the extra cameras.
And there are other hardware decisions that just don't make a hell of a lot of sense in there. So it's running Snapdragon 652, I believe, which is it's an octa-core chip, 4A72s, 4A53s, but it's on this really old manufacturing process. So you don't really get the benefit of the designs there, because you're using a 2 or 3 year old 28 nanometer process. It seems very strange that they would have shipped such an expensive and groundbreaking in a lot of ways in terms of what it can do, a device, using that chip, as opposed to using a more traditional high-end piece of hardware for that. It just seems a really strange chip to use, and that probably hasn't helped them as they've been developing this.
Well, I'm pretty sure they probably need the 4 high-end cores for all the processing that's going on in the background, and Samsung doesn't offer enough in quantity to do it. So they had to go with, you know, something from the 600 series that was true octa-core.
I think that's the least of the thing's problems, to be honest.
Yeah, I think
it goes back to... I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say the biggest problem is that you can only buy it at Lowe's.
I think it all goes back to the fact that the development and design went onto the Tango features and the sensors and the cameras, and, you know,
and they didn't have a consumer product person do the rest of it.
If that required you to use a specific type of processor, you know, those processors are, you know, they're out there, but they're not the name everybody looks for. And those processors have other issues. I know the battery life on that thing's got to suck. I don't even have to read the review to know it's got to be horrible, because I know what processor is in it and I know how big the screen is.
Well, I think that they had to do this from the perspective of they wanted to show that, hey, we could get look at all this stuff that used to fit in like a really thick, ugly 8-inch tablet. Now it fits in something approximating roughly a giant phone. But the problem is that they didn't have to then release the thing and try to sell it at Lowe's so that you can measure a room before you paint it.
I think Lowe's is the perfect place to sell it. I think we're kind of approaching this wrong. This isn't a phone that, if you're listening to this podcast and you work in an office, or, you know, you build car parts or whatever for a living and just play on your phone in your spare time, it's not for you. If you're a carpenter or some other sort of contractor who works in homes, you could probably find it useful, and you don't care how long it'll play, you know, Angry Birds or whatever.
Well, I think from that perspective, it would have been better to make it a tablet appliance type device, not try to make it a phone as well.
Right, like it was originally.
But then no one's buying Android tablets, so it's like, well, what do you do?
But I mean, that's why I'm saying don't make it a traditional tablet. Make it an appliance that this is what it does. It's in the form factor of an 8-inch tablet, but all it does is the measuring stuff and the AR and, you know, those kind of helpful features. Don't try to make it like a all-around multimedia flagship phone. It's just, it can't do all that stuff, at least not, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Don't buy one.
Yeah, don't buy one. Wait for the second version or the third, probably.
Or just don't buy one because you probably, I mean, just use a tape measure instead. I
mean, and you know, if you're one of the few people who can use it to map out how much crown molding you need in a client's dining room, then heck yeah, you can also make a phone call with it while you're eating your lunch. But don't buy it for the weekends to play on Facebook or something because you're going to hate it.
So speaking of measuring things, earlier before the show, we were making light fun of the new Gear S3's altitude feature, its ability to measure.
I was wondering what direction you're going to take that there, but that's a good
segue.
Wait a
second. Yeah, while you're introducing this, I'm going to check my altitude.
Right, because it's changing, even though Andrew has not moved for the last 2 hours. So we got the Gear S3 in-house this week, and this was announced back at IFA, right? So it's been a couple of months.
Yeah,
and we got.
Yeah, we can all remember the launch event for that that thing. That was a pretty interesting experience.
It was horrendous.
Well, I wasn't there. Anyway. Why don't you give us a little quick recap?
So it was effectively a very cringeworthy presentation. It was at the Tempodrome, where Samsung always does its presentations. Big circular arena. Last year they had presenters come out in turn into like a central stage. A lot of Samsung employees, so it wasn't necessarily people that you'd recognize, but a good amount of diversity there. But a very clear message in terms of what the Gear S3 and Gear S2 and S2 Classic at the time could do. But this time around, they were getting watch journalists and fashion journalists in, and it was, I think we called them the Watch Bros, the three of them who had this presentation. The tone of it was just so weird. You could see the auto cue. It was very artificial. And it just didn't. It just played to everything that people seem to think is wrong with smartwatches. Like, is this male only? You know, look at me. I have this giant thing on my wrist. Kind of world. It didn't really work.
Yeah, and that's a good point because Andrew, you know, you're wearing it. You know how much larger it is than the Gear S2. What do you think the reason for Samsung's decision was? They're obviously keeping the Gear S2 on the market as a more accessible smartwatch, but
yeah, and I'm taking my Gear S2 out at the right now. It's been sitting in a box, but and go ahead.
It is, you know, very masculine. It's not. It's a very oversized watch, in the vein of one of these very, overtly. I don't know. It's not exactly the most attractive product, in my opinion. It's not universal.
Well,
so,
and I think we have to set the stage here that there are two different Gear S3 models. They have the Classic and the Frontier, and the Frontier is absolutely the more masculine of the two. The Classic looks very similar to the Gear S2 Classic, so we have to remember that there is a slightly less masculine one, but they're both large and heavy, and I don't see how anyone with a smaller wrist is ever going to want to wear either one of them.
Right. But is it that much better than the Gear S2? And why would you want it over the Gear S2?
Well, so I think that the most interesting thing there is Samsung is going to continue to sell the Gear S2 and is going to take the software build that they're introducing, a few different features and mostly just UI changes on the Gear S3, and they're going to bring that to the Gear S2 as well. So that's kind of Samsung admitting from the start that they don't think that everybody is going to want the Gear S3 anyway, which is kind of hilarious because if they recognize that fact, then maybe they should have just made the Gear S3 smaller or had a version that's smaller.
But they already do. I mean, the hardware of the Gear S2 is basically identical. They already have that watch. It was released a year ago.
So that's what I'm... That's what I'm saying. So they could have released a new one rather than saying, hey, if you're somebody that wants a smaller, more sleek, or more gender neutral watch, go ahead and buy last year's model. But, like, that's just not a good...
If there's nothing new to contribute in the internal hardware, which there isn't, then what will be new about it?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure that they could figure something out. I'm just saying, this response of you can buy the old one is piss poor. You can't do that.
I think a lot of this you can buy the old one stuff when you see it from any company is, hey, what do we do with all these parts we've got laying around from the last year's model? We don't want to just recycle them and send them off somewhere. You use them.
I'm not convinced it's that with in this case. Well, I'm thinking.
Here's the thing: it's the Gear S3 is entirely different externally. I mean, the only thing they reused in it was the processor.
Right.
No, I meant why they're still selling the Gear S2. Why not? If they still have the stuff there, why stop selling it?
Well, I think their thing was they had to sell it because nobody's going to want the giant Gear S3. I think the Gear S2 probably did pretty well. And I think the sportier basic one probably did better than the classic, because the classic itself was already kind of bigger and masculine. But now you're going to the Gear S3. It has a bigger display. It has a bigger bezel around the outside. It still does the rotating thing, which is great. But it's also like 14 millimeters thick. And I mean, it's really large. I'm going to look up the exact specs while I think Daniel had a point to make.
And if you're from the United States and aren't you know, sure what that means, stack 14 dimes on top of each other. That's how thick this watch is.
I think that there is a much slower replacement cycle with smartwatches. We've seen it with the Android Wear line. The fact that the Huawei Watch, the Moto 360 2015 are, you know, those two are still what we would consider the latest Android Wear smartwatches. The idea that Samsung can keep the Gear S2 on the shelf and call it a modern device speaks to the fact that the smartwatch is more like a tablet in its replacement cycle.
Oh, sure. And I definitely agree that the Gear S2 is still a good device, and it's going to be one that's probably going to do very well considering that it's smaller, thinner, lighter,
and now cheaper,
More attractive to more people, and $100-something cheaper. I mean, so the Gear S3 in Wi-Fi Bluetooth version is $350 starting, and you're talking about $400 to $500-something for the LTE version. Like, that's a lot for a lot of people.
And the same experience, right? The software experience is exactly the same. The performance is basically the same. It isn't going to be discontinued anytime soon because it's the same internal hardware, more or less, as the Gear S3.
As soon as that new software arrives for the Gear S2, then it's going to be a lot easier to just say, go ahead and get that. I mean, okay, so I've only had the Gear S3 for like a little over a day. I've used it before, so I don't want to put too much judgment on it until I actually use it. Samsung's user experience on the watch tries to do too much. It's trying to do even more now. That's a problem. But it is fast and slick and well designed and consistent throughout.
And you can ignore, and it works. You could ignore all the extraneous stuff, right? You can just use it for weather and music controls and notification and mirroring, and it's just fine at all those things.
And to know how high you are.
You can skip. I mean, the first thing I did was, you know, they have all these, I guess, widgets they call them, which the problem is, you know, is already you have widgets on your watch, but they have multiple home screen panels that you can rotate through. And, you know, the first thing I did was press and hold one and clear out about half of them because I don't need all of these things. But that's the whole point. You can clear those out. You don't have to click into the all apps screen, which I'm still super frustrated that there's an all apps screen on your watch. But, you know, you don't have to use all that stuff. You can just use it, like Alex was saying, you know, weather, notifications. You can see, you know, incoming phone calls, text messages. It has a heart rate sensor. It can also take automatic heart rate throughout the day. It can do, it can tell you, how high you are, which, by the way, so it It gives you a graphic.
Does that through an altimeter, not a blood test, by the way.
Yes, it has an altimeter barometer combination in it, and it shows a graph over the last 6 hours of what your height was, which is, I'm not really sure how useful that is, but you can see that the graph has gone up and down, even though I have been in my apartment at the same height all morning. So, you know, we talked about this before we started the recording, where it's something like that is like a perfect example of the Gear S3. You know, if you're somebody that needs to know your exact altitude, you're hiking or you're whatever, you're not going to rely on a Gear S3 to tell you what your altitude is, because you know it's not accurate to the point where you can get an actual altimeter or barometer and know what's going on there. You know, I'm also not going to use this for super accurate measurements of anything else. I'm not going to use it to make phone calls. I'm not going to use it to rely on the heart rate, you know, throughout the day, other than to know, you know, how it moved from yesterday. So it's like, now you've kind of knocked off some of the features that people would maybe want to spend $350 for.
But I think people buying a watch would want that money to go less towards functionality and more towards aesthetics. Maybe that's the more important upgrade.
And I guess I should talk about that point too. It is, if you do like big watches and you like this kind of style of slightly more rugged with this, you know, like one of these elastomer bands that, you know, looks nice. And it's this, the Frontier is like a gunmetal, like a two-tone gunmetal gray brown kind of thing. And it ships with a very nice watch face on it. And like those things look like, it looks nice. It looks about as nice as maybe a $150 analog watch in terms of the feel. Now, justify the other $200.
Well, Tizen.
People who are watch fans aren't buying these.
No, it's people that are in that middle ground. They want a smartwatch, but they don't want something that looks like a Pebble.
Right. And that's, I mean, it sounds to me, all the complaints that I'm hearing, it sounds like Samsung nailed it. And this is exactly what those people are looking for. And I'm sorry that excludes people with small wrists and maybe excludes women. That sucks. And you should be able to have some company make what you want too, but I can't fault Samsung for catering to the people who are actually going to spend the money and buy it.
Well, yeah. I mean, yes, I get the fact that they're not going to be able to make five different Gear S3s that all meet, you know, a wide range of everybody's needs. But I think the problem is that by making it bigger, thicker, and heavier than last year, they lost out on a lot of the people that, you know, they enjoyed the Gear S2 or enjoyed the idea of the Gear S2, who knows how many actually bought them, because it was smaller and more, I don't know, normal to wear than one of the, you know, a Huawei watch, but, like Alex said.
Yeah, but I mean, as someone who's used a Gear S2, a fair bit over the past year, I don't view the S3 as a replacement for it. I'm still perfectly happy with it. And when it, like you say, when it gets that software update, it's fine. I get the same experience as I would get had I purchased the larger, more expensive watch that I don't want anyway because it's larger and more expensive.
But Alex, the Gear S3 has a clip you can hang your truck nuts from. And you need to Google that because you're in the UK. But
I need to Google it.
Please
I'm
don't.
In Canada.
No, you don't want to either. You might have to turn Safe Search off. But I think that the problem is that the Gear S3 is going into a market of smartwatches that people have not resoundingly decided that they want a smartwatch. And then, so I think from Jerry's point earlier, they're doing some of the right things and that they're saying, okay, we already know that we can't appeal to everybody. So let's just put a giant battery and a bigger, brighter screen and a ton of features in it. And maybe that'll appeal to the niche people that actually want a smartwatch. But at the same time, I feel like they've lost more people on the other ends that won't be buying your newest thing. They might buy the older thing and then feel a little hard.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think they wouldn't have had them in the first place.
This whole category, you know, even Apple can't have a huge success with a smartwatch. So, we're already not looking for them.
We've already seen Apple move towards less of a smartwatch, more of a fitness band approach with the Apple Watch this year. So if they're doing that, then I mean, I guess Samsung has a similar kind of thing with the Gear Fit.
Right. So that's kind of my point that I was making earlier is like, I didn't really think about how big the Gear S3 was until I was using the Gear Fit 2 for the past month. And I, you know, which does all the fitness stuff and including GPS tracking, but it also does the most basic smartwatch things that we were talking about, the only things that people care about, which is notifications, incoming calls, and a couple of, you know, heads up display kind of, you know, glanceable information. It doesn't tell you what your altitude is, but people don't care about that anyway.
Yeah. So the Gear S2 or the Gear Fit 2 does have a GPS built in, which is...
Yes, it does, which is nice.
I think we are going to wrap up there for this week. Thank you, everybody who submitted questions. Some of them we didn't get to. One we will talk about for just a second. And the question was, where the heck is Phil? And we now have an answer, or we can now tell you the answer. The answer is Modern Dad. Phil is back. He has a brand. It is called Modern Dad. It is the second video project from Mobile Nations. You can find him at youtube.com/moderndad and on Twitter at MDRNDAD and everywhere else at the same MDRNDAD. But we are very happy that Phil is finally back in our lives. We've been waiting for this moment. We know that he's worked a lot, very hard, and we're really looking forward to the content that he puts out. And we will have him on the podcast when he has a free moment to talk about Modern Dad. So that will be really fun. But until then, we will leave you with Andrew Martinick. Where can people find you on the Twitters and the Facebooks?
By my name. It's super easy. I don't use any weird handles like modern MDRN Dad or anything like that.
ANDRW.
Actually, I should test that out. It would make all of my handles a lot shorter.
Yeah. And
I'm not gonna do. It's okay.
Jerry, how can people find you?
Well, if you turn left at the Elk gas station, if you get off the interstate, you can come to my house, or you can find me on Twitter, and it's at GBHIL, because I do like stupid weird abbreviations.
Just one vowel again.
Yeah. On Google Plus, if you have something that you want to make sure it catches my attention, the best place to do it is a private message on Google Plus, especially if you want me to look at something you've done or something you make. Those are just easier for me to keep track of. Twitter gets a little noisy for me. I'm just not that guy. And then, of course, I'm at jerry@androidcentral.com because I still like email.
And Alex, are you that guy?
Well, if you take a right at the Elk gas station, you'll come to it. No. I am at Alex Dolby on all of the things, mostly Twitter and Instagram these days. Also, alex@androidcentral.com, and direct your internet browser of choice to that same URL for all of my stuff. That is where it lives.
All right. And my name is Daniel Bader. You can find me at Twitter, on Twitter at JourneyDan. Same on Instagram, posting puppy photos galore. If you want to meet Zadie, you can go there. And you can find everything we do at Android Central, as Alex said. And if you are listening to this on your day off on Thanksgiving in the US, have a very safe and happy and tasty Thanksgiving. See you later, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
See you later.